Hello, fellow foodies. Welcome back and thanks for listening. I've got a really cool show for you today. If you've ever heard of the mind-altering effects of some interesting edible cacti like peyote and San Pedro before, but you aren't super familiar with the cultural history and pharmacology of these plants, then this is the podcast episode for you. The psychoactive compound mescaline is found in both of these plants. Mescaline occurs naturally as a secondary metabolite of the peyote cactus, which is known by its scientific name of Lophophora williamsii. And it is also found in the San Pedro cactus, which has a scientific name of Echinopsis pachanoi. Mescaline is also produced by the Peruvian torch cactus, or Echinopsis peruviana, as well as some other members of the Cactaceae family. With regards to chemical class, mescaline is an alkaloid, and its hallucinogenic effects have been compared to the synthetic compound LSD and also to the natural compound psilocybin. In this episode, I speak with author and expert on psychedelic drugs, Mike J., about his new book on mescaline. Mike has written extensively on the history of science, medicine, drugs, and mental health. His books include High Society, Mind-Altering Drugs in History and Culture, which was published in 2010, and his most recent book, Mescaline, A Global History of the First Psychedelic, published in 2018. Mike is based in London, UK, and writes regularly for the Wall Street Journal and the London Review of Books.
For coming on the show, reading your fascinating book entitled Mescaline, A Global History of the First Psychedelic.
And pleasure to be here.
Thank you. And as an ethnobotanist, of course, I'm fascinated with the important role that plants have in culture and in history, and especially when it comes to this subject. I think it's really a tale of two cacti. So maybe we start there.
Sure.
So can you tell us a little bit about these two cacti? Let's start perhaps with peyote. And what is peyote and where does it grow in the world?
Right. Well, the peyote cactus is a very small little button-like cactus that grows in the desert in northern Mexico and just a little bit over the border in Texas around Laredo and in that area. And it contains about 3-5% maybe of mescaline. So if you eat, you know, half a dozen of these little peyote cactus buttons, you have a pretty strong psychedelic experience.
Wow. And so are they just eaten raw? Are they stored fresh or dried or what's the preparation involved?
You can eat them raw. Some people do. Often they're dried. Drying is very simple, especially out in the desert. You just kind of get a needle and a thread and you can string up dozens of them. And you then just hang them in the desert sun and they dry out and go very kind of light and sort of feathery. And you can then grind them up into a powder, and they're very stable in that state. They're very light and easy to transport, and they retain their potency for years.
Great. And as a psychedelic, these have also had a lot of important roles in the cultural heritage of Native peoples of the Western United States. Could we talk a little bit about that? And how have these plants been used historically?
Sure. I mean, they've been used. There's evidence of the peyote being used way, way back. There's a cave kind of down in South Texas where people have found dried peyote buttons, 3,000-4,000 years old. The first kind of direct evidence that we get of how they're being used is when the Spanish arrived in Mexico about 500 years ago, and they talk about two different things. Of course, you've got to filter through kind of the way that the Spanish write about this, because they're very preoccupied with, you know, they're coming from Europe, you know, with the witch craze at its height. So this is all kind of devilry and sorcery. You know, so you have to glance through that a little bit. But if you do that, you can see two different patterns there. One is the peyote being used in kind of healing or divination as a sort of one-on-one thing with something that we might call a curandero or a shaman, or maybe something more like a therapist working together with a patient. And that we still find with these cacti going on traditionally. And then the other thing, which is described more in the north of Mexico, where they come from, and where people like the Huichol people in Mexico still, they're very central to them. You get descriptions of kind of big communal ceremonies where, you know, a whole village would take the peyote together, usually around a fire, usually at night, with singing and dancing.
Oh, fascinating. And I know that in the more recent history, I believe it was in 1918 that the Native American Church was founded. Is that correct? Can you tell us a bit about that and the role of peyote in that process?
Yeah, sure. That's such an interesting story, I think. So by this point, the Spanish banned peyote in the 17th century, because they decided that the visions that it gave the local people were produced by the devil. But of course, people still carried on using it. And by the late 19th century, there was a little bit of a trade kind of, in this area around the Rio Grande and what's now the Texas-Mexico border, the area where peyote grew. And there's some of the plains tribes of the southwest United States encountered it there, and Apache bands, for example. But it was really after the Indian Wars, when the Indian tribes were in that forced captivity on the reservations, after the ghost dance, a lot of traditional ceremonies like the sun dance were prohibited, on the reservations by the federal authorities and by the missionaries. And singing and dancing generally was banned. And the other thing that happened around this time was the Texas Railroad got going, so it was possible for peyote to be transported up into places like Oklahoma and to tribes who had never encountered it before. And that's when you start hearing the first reports of, this teepee ceremony, which was originally a kind of clandestine secret ceremony. It was done in the teepee, and it was done at night so that the white authorities didn't see that it was going on. And you get figures like Quanah Parker, the chief of the Comanches, who are very instrumental in its spread, becoming kind of sort of apostles of this practice. And it's everybody sitting down, mostly men in those days. This is a generation who have come up as warriors and are now living in captivity with just incredible cultural trauma. And so what emerges is this kind of this ceremony in which the peyote is a kind of sacrament that allows people to conjure, the old world and the old medicine inside this teepee at night. They can create this space, where the old magic still works. And it spreads from tribe to tribe, much as the ghost dance did, probably starting with the Comanche and the Kiowa and the Apache, and radiating out from there. And from the very, very beginning, as soon as the missionaries and the federal government hear about it, they try to ban it. And there's lots of, local state bans on peyote and on trafficking it and possessing it on reservations. And by 1918, there's a big attempt at a federal ban, adding it to the list of banned substances, along with, opium and cocaine and morphine. And that's when a bunch of Oklahoma tribes get together with a couple of white figures, sort of lawyers and ethnographers, and they decide for their own protection they should incorporate this form of worship and call it a church. They incorporate the Native American church, as you say, in 1918. And so after that, it's their sacrament. It's written into their articles. So they're protected by the First Amendment, by the freedom of worship.
That's a fascinating way to get around those laws. And today, still, consumption of peyote is considered it's illegal in the U.S. Is that correct?
It is. And it's just, I mean, it's just amazing that it's survived. And in fact, in the Native American church is now bigger than it's ever been. It's spread out of Oklahoma across the Southwest, and then it spread to the rest of the U.S. And there was a Native American Church of America, and then it spread to the First Nations in Canada. So it had to be renamed the Native American Church of North America. And, this is it's had legal challenges all the way. This has been a century of really hard struggle for the Native American Church. Mm-hmm. But it's been an incredibly important part of their, their cultural emergence and their cultural strength, because, when this started in 1918, the official federal policy was still assimilation. So, all Indian kids were taken off to boarding schools and, not allowed to speak their own languages. And, the Native American church became a real repository of the old culture, and it's been a real kind of center of that cultural renaissance.
That's amazing. So important to the cultural heritage. Mm-hmm. And what is the current status of peyote in the wild? So is this something that is cultivated, or is it just wild harvested, and are wild populations at risk at all from overharvest?
Cultivation of peyote is prohibited. It can only be gathered and collected. And it's a kind of strange arrangement that used to be kind of managed by the state of Texas and is now by the Drug Enforcement Agency. There are three or four licensed peyoteros, they're called, people who are allowed to gather the peyote. Often these are Hispanic families who've been doing it for generations. And if you are a registered tribe, and you're a chapter of the Native American Church within that tribe, you can legally order up peyote from these small number of licensed suppliers. But the pressures are really intense now, because the demand is growing. As I said, the Native American Church is bigger now than it's ever been, and there's also, of course, loads of people now in the modern sort of white psychedelic culture very interested in peyote. Supply is also shrinking, because a lot of what used to be called the peyote gardens, I heard people talking about walking on peyote like kind of walking on mattresses, it covered miles and miles, and that's such a lot of that kind of precious garden is now given over to agriculture or grazing.
So cattle ranches, basically.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And south of the border in Mexico, there's an enormous amount of harvesting of it now for traditional medicines. So you'll see pretty much everywhere you go in Mexico, there are stalls of herbal medicine sellers selling, what are supposed to be peyote tinctures or peyote oils or peyote pastes, sometimes kind of peyote and marijuana, because I guess these substances have a kind of magical, these plants have a kind of magical aura around them. So who knows? I mean, nobody's doing analysis of these things to find out how much peyote is in them. But for sure, around the places where it traditionally grows, like around Real de Catorce, up in the high desert, you don't find it anywhere near as much as you used to. The villages where it used to grow, you now have to walk quite a long way into the desert, and people are kind of digging it up with, plant machinery. Peyote should be cut very carefully. If you, it's traditionally harvested by people who cut it just above ground level. And if you do that, you break, there's a kind of enzyme there that suppresses growth, and you kind of break that enzyme channel if you do that, and then it sends up more pups, as they're called, little peyotes. But of course, if you dig it out of the ground by the root, then that's it.
Yeah, and that's probably definitely contributing to population decline for this. Mm-hmm. Your comment on not knowing about levels of mescaline in some of these different prepared products reminds me very much of what we're seeing also with the new cannabis industry that's emerged with different edible products. There's not a lot of control over levels of the active compounds in such products. That also extends, of course, to the plant populations themselves. Have you ever encountered any information about certain varieties of peyote that tend to have more potent effects, or are they generally considered equivalent when it comes to dosing?
There's more than one species of peyote, and they all have lots of alkaloids in. The classic peyote has about 50 different alkaloids and quite a lot of mescaline. Others have kind of less mescaline, so there's a bit of variation that way. There's lots of people have done bioassays, and you get very kind of varied readings. But with the other cactus that we're going to come onto, the San Pedro, there are many different species with different potencies. But with peyote, there's kind of one species, the Lophophora williamsii, and I guess levels are pretty similar, across that species, because it all grows in pretty much the same habitat.
Yeah, fascinating. Well, I want to walk our audience through what the experience of consumption of peyote is like. Could you tell us, how much does one usually take under these ritual circumstances, and when do the effects begin, and how long do they last for?
There's an amazing literature writing about peyote and mescaline in general, because when it was first came to the attention of Western science, kind of in the 1890s, that was the time when scientists, if they were interested in mind-altering or psychoactive plants or drugs, would take them themselves and record their experiences. So that it's unbelievably rich, and you can see that it's very different for different people. If you look at on Wikipedia or in a sort of pharmacology reference book, then people will mostly say, this is similar in effect to other psychedelics like LSD or psilocybin from mushrooms and so on. But it's a little more, you have to take a rather larger dose. It doesn't cross the blood-brain barrier so easily. It's a little slower to come on, and it's got more sort of physical effects. So you may not notice anything for an hour or two, and then you will start to feel a kind of fullness and a heaviness, maybe a blood pressure drop, a bit of euphoria, a bit of mood elevation, or maybe the opposite. You might, feel like you're coming down with a fever. And then you start to get, what most people in the West are interested in is these visual hallucinations. You close your eyes and you see these amazing, brilliant kaleidoscope images. And this continues for a long time, for sort of often 10 or 12 hours. So all night. So within a
wow. Wait a second.
Sure.
10 to 12 hours of visual hallucination. Oh my goodness. That's a lot.
And also, 10 to 12 hours of, if it's a large dose, you feel quite physically kind of steamrolled. It's a cardiac stimulant, your heart sort of beats a little bit faster. And of course, it's a general central nervous stimulant, like all psychedelics. You're not going to fall asleep. But at the same time, you can get it can become kind of quite hard to move. And in the ritual context in which, I've been lucky enough to take it in the peyote meetings of the Native American Church is, I think, really just beautifully kind of geared to get the most out of these effects. You start off with a lot of opening the ritual while the effects are building. and then drumming and singing, you know, with a drum and a rattle, and being passed around the circle, and people singing their own songs of their own lineages. And that's kind of very helpful, I think, to keep the energy levels up and to bring everybody into the same kind of group consciousness. And then kind of at midnight, the roadman, the sort of master of ceremonies, blows on an eagle bone whistle. Everything stops. Water is passed around for the first time. And then you pick up again. And that signals the end of this phase when you're really feeling the physical effects. And that moment after midnight is, you know, when you really get into the flow.
Fascinating. And I'm wondering, with other entheogens, for example, with ayahuasca, there are also a number of other side effects, which can include vomiting and diarrhea. Do you also have those sorts of effects when taking peyote?
Not so much, but you do get quite a lot of nausea. So for some people notice this more than others. For some people, it's the predominant effect of the experience. I think there's a big difference between whether you're taking it kind of on your own or in a ceremony. I think if you take peyote or mescaline generally on your own, it's just very overwhelming, all these physical sensations, these visual hallucinations, aural hallucinations, you know, hearing kind of singing and voices and music. You get very wrapped up in your own sensorium. But if you take it in a group ceremony with this kind of structured ritual around it that you have to pay attention to, it becomes quite a different experience. And you notice, I think, that physical nausea rather less.
That's interesting. Well, I wonder if we could talk a bit about also the work that was done once kind of Western science became interested in peyote and mescaline, and what sorts of experiments were being done in the late 1800s and early 1900s on this?
This is a fascinating chapter, because we tend to think of the history of psychedelics as kind of starting in the 50s or the 60s, you know, and but in fact, there was an enormous, you know, interest in peyote and mescaline, you know, 50 years earlier than that. So unsurprisingly, some of the first people to be interested in it were pharmacists. The leading pharmacy at that time was Park Davis in Detroit. And as soon as they started to hear stories about this, they got very, very interested, got samples, started testing them. And in the 1890s already, they had a kind of peyote preparation out on the market, tincture, which they recommended in low doses as a cardiac stimulant and a respiratory stimulant. And, you know, because it's quite, at that time, there weren't that many stimulants. You know, this was before amphetamines or whatever. So something that brought your heartbeat up and kept you awake was pretty interesting just for that reason, despite everything else that it did.
Yeah, but I guess this is also the time where we had, you know, Vin Mariani and kind of cocaine being introduced to different soda fountains and beverages that were being created in the late 1800s as well. You had cocaine and caffeine. There was a huge interest across pharmacy and the beverage kind of production industry that was starting to emerge for these stimulants.
That's right. And of course, 7-Up originally used to have lithium in it.
Really?
Yeah. So the soda beverage was kind of regarded as, you know, a really good administration mechanism for, you know, pharmaceutical products. And but peyote never really took off on that level, but it became very, very interesting to medical science and to people studying the mind, because you know, these were very exotic mental phenomena, these visual hallucinations, and also the fact that weren't really sort of delirious while you were taking it. You could have all these amazing sensations. And at the same time, if somebody said to you, what's going on, you could say, well, I'm seeing all these silver circles rotating counterclockwise. And now they're kind of zooming towards me. And I'm seeing, you know, people could describe in enormous detail what they were seeing at the time, you know, quite rationally.
Wow.
Artists became very interested in it. There's a lot of art produced by surrealists and modernist artists who wanted to take it and see if they could see what it did for them. And also psychiatrists would give it to artists to get them to paint and draw their hallucinations. A lot of art critics and aesthetes would take it and write kind of beautiful descriptions of the visions they were seeing and compare them to different art traditions around the world. So there's this incredible psychedelic literature back then that's very little known about.
Amazing. And so where do you see the future of peyote going after all this research? Do you think that there's a role for it in medicine in general, or do you think it will remain primarily for cultural traditions?
I think, as with a lot of psychedelics, if you look at the way it's used, so take the Native American peyote meeting, there are healings in the context of those meetings. Different chapters of the Native American church have play this rather differently, but quite often somebody will ask before the ceremony for a special healing, and they'll be given it. And if you look at what's going there, it's going on there, it's incredibly powerful. One of the things it's always been used for from the beginning, for example, is treating alcoholism. You can see how incredibly effective it is in that context there, because this is a ceremony that you're engaged in with kind of, the support of your community, with everybody around you. These are all the people you're going to spend the rest of your life with, and you're all put in this very, very suggestible state and taken through this ceremony, and you know that this ceremony is a life-changing moment. It's the kind of ceremony in which someone might have said to you, as a teenager, you are now an adult. So in that context, if someone says to you, the sickness has gone away, you're going to be healed, you don't need alcohol anymore. You know, that's very, very powerful.
Yeah.
So the question is, I think, is how do you transpose that into Western clinical medicine? Because, which is kind of a private transaction between a doctor and a patient, with a very different power dynamic. The doctor does stuff to the patient and the patient kind of lies there passively. So I think a lot of the real therapeutic power of peyote and other entheogens is that the patient is a participant, and it's meant to be an ordeal. It's meant to be risky. Clinicians don't like risk, but the patient has to really feel they've put themselves out there, they've done something brave. That's an important part, sort of component of the healing, I think. So you can see why, for example, with ayahuasca, with veterans with PTSD, if you look at the way that kind of therapeutics is emerging, it's much more the group ceremony and it's much less the clinical appointment with the psychiatrist. So I think it's hard to see whether clinical psychiatry is going to find a way of encompassing this type of healing, or whether it's going to create a sort of new therapeutics for itself.
Yeah, no, I think you definitely hit it there with the importance of the group dynamics to the healing process, and having this really robust community, and like you said, having skin in the game of having real engagement, not just being a passive recipient of a medicine. That's so important. Well, and moving on to some other areas of medicine where entheogens are used, let's talk a bit about that other cactus. Let's talk about San Pedro. And maybe we can begin by, if you could tell us a bit about where San Pedro grows and which cultures use it.
Yeah, I mean, this is the mysteries of nature. I mean, how strange that mescaline should only exist in nature in cacti. And then in two cacti that are so different, the peyote and the San Pedro are about as distantly related as cacti can be. And they look completely different. The San Pedro is this classic cartoon cactus, big, tall, columnar, spiny cactus. And it grows all the way down the Andes from Ecuador down through Colombia, Peru, Bolivia, down to Argentina. at a particular altitude, kind of sort of 2,000 meter belt, when you're up above, you know, out of the humid belt, and you're kind of up in that kind of more sort of barren, scree coloured mountain, where you get, you know, 3 months of rain a year and 9 months of solid sun. It loves it up there, the San Pedro, or the Huachuma, as it's called in Quechua or Aymara. It grows very, very fast. It grows everywhere. It's very abundant. That's another, I think, very important contrast with the peyote, where the peyote is very slow growing and very, you know, endangered, you know, in its habitat. There is no shortage of San Pedro in the world. And I think for that reason, that's taking over now among kind of sort of people who are interested in entheogens and sort of natural sources of mescaline these days. It's used traditionally in healing, and it was there are a couple of strong sort of places where this held on. Again, like peyote, it was prohibited, and in fact until the 1960s it was illegal. There were laws against witchcraft which stopped, you know, banned curanderos from using it. But on the coast in Peru is where it hung on, and where it was first studied, and where it was first established that the San Pedro cactus contained mescaline. There's a tradition of sort of curanderos there, which is working with it in this other way that we talked about earlier, with the kind of the curandero, and the patient, and the and the San Pedro, you know, the three of them coming together in a healing ritual.
Mm. So in this case, you have the healer will take it along with the patient. Is that the idea?
That's right. Yeah. Usually, okay. Sometimes only the healer takes it. And the idea is that the three of them, the healer and the patient and the San Pedro, all work together. And in the way that this is done in Peru, the main thing that a San Pedro curandero has is a mesa or a table, which has lots of objects on it which are particular to them. They might be little effigies or pictures of saints or members of their family or crystals, or, you know, just a whole bunch of things that are meaningful to them that, you know, are set out there. The San Pedro has rather less mescaline in it than the peyote. It's rather less concentrated, so it's always prepared by brewing. It's just the spines are taken out, it's chopped up like a zucchini and boiled, and then you get this liquid which is kind of bitter tasting and a bit slimy and sort of yellowish, and that's drunk. And then there's usually tobacco involved, sanctifying the sort of four cardinal points. Often there's rum or pisco or alcohol as well to please the spirits. Always perfumes, strong floral incenses. And the combination of all this with the San Pedro creates this kind of magical space in which the objects on the mesa are said to kind of catch the light. You know, some of them appear particularly sort of significant, and that's a medium through which the curandero and the patient can kind of talk, a bit like a tarot card reading or whatever.
Yeah, that's interesting and distinct from the way that peyote is then consumed. Because here, is it uncommon then to have a larger group that takes San Pedro together? Is it typically just a healer and patient?
In that context, it is. That's the context that's survived all that sort of persecution and prohibition. So who knows what it was like before. Mm. There are quite a lot of indications that before, in the pre-Hispanic period, there were more communal gatherings. There are ancient temple sites where carvings of San Pedro cacti, where you've got that big kind of plaza, and it looks as if it was used for kind of group ceremonies. And there are descriptions of it being used, maybe mixed with a kind of chicha beer at kind of, you know, larger ceremonies. So I imagine it was used in that way before, but what's come down to us, again, a bit like the TP ceremony, is something that could be clandestine, that could fly under the radar more easily.
Mm. Yeah. And today, so you mentioned that San Pedro is not threatened like peyote is. Is San Pedro primarily wildcrafted, or do people also cultivate it?
People do cultivate it. It's legal to cultivate in a lot of places. I don't know exactly what the law is in the US. It's kind of a gray area because, of course, the mescaline that it contains is Schedule 1, you know, but the plant itself, you know, it's a bit like you're allowed to have poppy seed buns, even though they've probably got a little trace of opium in them. So people cultivate it, particularly in California. People have been cultivating it for a long time. I think it's probably been cultivated for a very long time up in the Andes, because you've got all these different varieties. People use it for all kinds of different things, as well as a medicine, because it grows so quickly. Up in the sort of high altiplano country where it grows, you often see, you know, fences with it, you know, just you see it around buildings and stuff as a windbreak. So there's probably areas where it's been cultivated for a long time for small spines or a high mescaline content. But that's certainly happening now in California. There are people who've been working with it now for 20 or 30 years and, you know, selecting for the most potent specimens and probably producing something quite different from anything you'd find in the Andes by this time.
Yeah, that's amazing. It's always fascinating for me to see how plants can be used in multiple ways. I've seen this also with other cacti. I'm thinking of the Opuntia ficus indica, or the prickly pear fig, and that's used in a number of locations as a windbreak, like you mentioned, and then also as a source of food. So it's also
the cochineal beetle, you know,
absolutely,
and the nopales, you know, you eat it all the time in Mexico. It's like a, you know, like a green vegetable.
Yep, absolutely, yeah. Well, when San Pedro is harvested, so you mentioned these are quite large cacti. Mm-hmm. How do harvesters actually collect it? Do they collect it at the base, like you see with at ground level, or is it more you kind of lop off an arm or a top of the cactus?
Yeah, it's often taken off at base level. When you see it for sale in the markets, in the curandero markets in Peru, what people, you know, what's a quality product is, you know, a really nice, big, thick chunk of limb. So you get that further down. When you cut a San Pedro, then it kind of scabs over and then starts growing again. And then if you take the tip of the San Pedro and you leave that on a windowsill for a couple of weeks, that will scab over and you can plant it again. So it's very easy to, just from one plant when you start harvesting, to produce more and more. And it's usually the sort of the big thick stems that are the prime ones that you'll see in the markets down on the coast, you know, because it only grows up in the high mountains. So there's that trade of the cactus from the high Andes down to the coast, that was probably going on, you know, 1,000-2,000 years ago.
Wow, that's amazing. And have you noted any other kind of interesting elements around the culture of cacti throughout the Americas that you'd like to highlight? I mean, are there songs or art that's really dedicated to these cacti?
The Huichol people in Mexico, the peyote is very, very central to their way of life. They famously make this annual pilgrimage because they used to live in this area where peyote grew a lot, which they call Wirikuta in their language, which is their kind of Garden of Eden. But when the Spanish arrived, they moved up into the much more remote areas of the Sierra Madre, where they still live, the Sierra Huichol, it's called, where they could carry on their traditions. So that's a 200 or 300 mile pilgrimage that they make to their old peyote hunting grounds and back again. And they're kind of cosmology is very complex. They have the deer and the maize and the peyote. They're kind of three big symbols. And you see a lot of that in their art, and you've probably seen that Wichol art. It's very, very striking, you know, beautiful, multicolored, you know, to a Western eye, very psychedelic looking art, and often with the peyote motifs in it. Usually the peyote is seen from above, so it looks like a kind of hexagon with a dot in the middle and radiating out colors.
That's amazing. Well, as an author, I'm wondering, what was the most surprising or interesting thing that you came across while you were researching this book?
That's a really good question. There were various bits of the story of mescaline that I've looked at over the years, but there were other ones that just surprisingly appeared to me, kind of out of nowhere. I was fascinated to find in London, where I'm from, that a group of psychiatrists there in the 1930s were studying hallucinations, and they'd heard that mescaline produced hallucinations, so they decided to get some people to take it, and they thought, well, let's give it to some surrealist artists, because these are people who are used to working with automatic drawing and painting, and they're interested in the unconscious. So, yeah, in 1936, all the top surrealist artists in Britain were all injected with mescaline in a clinic and told to draw and paint what was going on. And that collection of art has just been sitting in the archives ever since, and never been shown. And so it was fantastic to get that out and have a look at it.
I can imagine. That's really interesting. Wow. Wow. Well, thank you so much, Mike, for coming on the show. This has been incredibly informative. Great information on edible medicinal plants, and some that have some really interesting pharmacological effects on the body. So thanks. And to the audience, make sure that you pick up your own copy of Mike J's book, Mescaline, A Global History of the First Psychedelic. Thanks.
Thanks, Cassandra.
If you'd like to learn more about mescaline and these fascinating cacti, then definitely check out Mike's latest book entitled Mescaline, A Global History of the First Psychedelic from your preferred bookseller. You can also find links to the book and access other materials written by Mike on his website at mikej.net, and that's spelled mikejay.net. We've got a fabulous lineup of topics and shows for you this season, so be sure to mark your calendars because new episodes will release each Monday. I'm Dr. Cassandra Quave, and you've been listening to Foodie Pharmacology, the science podcast for the food curious, recorded on Skype from home in Atlanta, Georgia during the COVID-19 isolation period. You can subscribe to the podcast on SoundCloud or on Apple Podcasts. If you like the show, please do leave us a rating on Apple Podcasts and spread the word. Thanks so much for listening, and I'll see you next time.